Buddho, Suvakato, Yena Bhagavata Dhammo, Supatipanno, Yasa Bhagavato, Savaka Sangho, Tamayang Bhagavantang, Sadamang Sasangang, Ime hi sakare hi atarahang, Avopite hi abhipujayama, Sadhu no bante Bhagava Suchira Parinibhutopi Pachima Janata Nukampa Manasa Ime Sakare Dugata Panakala Bhute Patigan Hatu Amhakang Dikharatang Hitaya Sukaya Alahang Samasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Iti piso Bhagava Arahang Sammasambuddho Vija Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manusana Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaya Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho amici patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yati dang chatavi purisa yugani atta purisa pugala esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjalikaraniyo anuttarak punyaketa lokasa tamahang sangang api pujayami tamahang sangang sirasa namami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, if not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. A question.
I'll put this on first off.
Very good.
Oh my goodness.
I'll put it up. Now, one thing about questions, it's always wonderful to actually ask a question, even if you know the answer. Simply because you know that many other peoples would like to know that answer. And you know, you may have heard people discuss this before, but you ask the question. And that means that when it gets to the interview times, I don't have to answer the same old question again and 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 again. Because in the interview times, it's just one-on-one. And the questions, you know, you ask a question, everybody hears it. And everybody knows the answer. So that's why these are more important than the interviews. But anyway, we do both. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, what is deluded samadhi? There is no such thing as deluded samadhi. It's an oxymoron. In other words, if it's samadhi, stillness, if it really is stillness, it's not deluded. The real samadhi, it's still really aware, really joyful. Maybe deluded samadhi, you think it's samadhi, you haven't really done your homework. Deluded samadhi is... you think you're still, but other people see you're not. But just as a quick check, because sometimes people ask, you know, well, I was very still and peaceful. Was that samadhi or what was going on? You know, after, when you come out of states of deep meditation, you're full of energy, really clear, you're really happy. And that's a really good sign. Without that, it's not samadhi. The afterglow is incredibly strong. People say, wow, well, I didn't really have that afterglow, but I'm sure it was samadhi. Sorry. My breath can be very short during my meditation. Should I take some deep breaths in and out if this happens? No, just let the breath be the breath. There hasn't been anybody die in Jhana Grove Retreat Center during one of my retreats. And I don't intend you to be the first. So you're perfectly safe. Just let the body do what the body needs to do. You don't tell it, oh, you're too short, do long, you're too long, do short. You just watch. Be as passive as you possibly can. And I do remember that story of this lady who, she came on quite a few of my retreats. And then one day she said she had this dream. And I praised her for it because it was a very vivid dream. And it's actually doing exactly what I've been instructing her, or rather brainwashing her for years. She dreamt she was in a car. And she was driving and I was in the passenger seat, which is not really supposed to be like that, but anyway, that's what she dreamt. And she lost control of the car. It was going really fast. And as it was going really, really fast, she saw the sign, dangerous cliff. And she started to freak out. And I said to her, according to her dream, just relax. And so she did. Just relax. And I said, take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, and really just let go. Don't try and control anything. And she did. We went over the cliff. And as we were going down the cliff, everything was fine. It was going really fast. But at the bottom of the cliff, we're just heading to the bottom of the cliff. And then there was, you know, a very steep bend. I said, no, just relax, it's okay.
And of course, we took that really high speed. We took that sort of curve at the bottom. We were going straight at very incredible speed. And there was a very sharp right turn. And she went to, you know, get hold of the steering wheel to turn. And I said, let it go, leave it alone. And she did. And we turned to the right. And we went right, you know, straight along the middle of that road. No problem at all. Totally survived. And she was so happy that she actually followed the instructions and it all worked out, even though it was only a dream. I'll just mention, if ever that happens in real life, just, no, please maybe do something different. And anyway, I'm not going to go in your car anymore. No, but it was just, in the meditation, that's what you do. Totally let go. Short breath, the body will look after itself. You just be an observer, not an owner, not a controller. It's much better. How to live harmoniously with difficult family members, especially those who often like to push their ideals onto you. Oh, it's just come on retreat a lot. Because at least you're away from your family members. And I don't know who those family members are, but look, this was one of those stories, because I used to travel a lot, and when I used to go to Malaysia and Singapore, I don't know, especially Malaysia, that sometimes these Buddhists have been Buddhists all their life, but then when they get very sick, you know, they're about to die, then, you know, maybe one of their kids, or one of their cousins, or nephews, or grandnieces, or whatever, you know, gets caught up in these evangelical churches. And so they go to the, they get their pastor and a few of their mates, and they go to the bedside, and they keep on just chanting for their grandfather to convert. You know, because otherwise they think, you know, that he's going to go to hell. Ah. And so, yeah, they're a bit, they're crazy, but, you know, you can understand where they're coming from. So that caused a lot of disturbance, you know, for the old gentleman or the old lady who was dying. They want a bit of peace at the end of their life, not being converted and chanted and praise the Lord this and praise the Lord that. You know, there's one of the gentlemen who comes here very often. He's actually back in Malaysia now. He comes up here and says, praise the Lord, praise the Lord. I'm sure you've heard him. Casey Wong. Praise the Lord Buddha. I don't know, the very idea of Lord, and that just so 19th century, not even 20th century. So, you know, the idea of someone controlling you, something that really rails against me. But anyway, so it was a problem. And it was, you know, in the newspaper, and they tried to stop this happening and stuff. But anyway, I came up with a solution. And I remember telling Dr. K.C. Dhammananda, one of my good friend, lovely monk, old monk, the solution is obvious. I don't know why no one else thought about it. You're in your bed there, you're dying, and your family members come past, and they say, please, you've got to convert, you're not really a Buddhist, Buddhist is not going to get you anywhere. So what should you do? Obvious, convert. Convert to being a Christian. And then they leave you alone. They go, hallelujah, wonderful. And then once they're out the door, then you convert back again. Being a Buddhist. You can convert one way, you can convert the other way. Fair enough. But the point is, you get them out of the way so you can die peacefully. That's the only way to get rid of them. Anyway, that's one way how to live harmoniously with difficult family members, just agree with them. And as soon as they're out of the room, go back to your normal way of looking at life. Is that a good idea? You can choose your friends, but you're stuck with your family. So if it's really difficult family members, I don't know why they want to control you and do stuff like that, but one of the things you can do, like one family member, like there's a Malaysian girl comes here, and she got married to an Australian. And she comes really regularly to temple. She said, I know my husband would really appreciate, you know, just doing some meditation, listen to some of these teachings, but he's just really into, you know, football and going down the pub and stuff. And so I said, no, I'll try to get him to come here, he won't listen. I said, it's so easy to do. And it worked. I said, go and get, you know, copy of one of my books or something. Take it home and tell your husband, this is my book, keep your hands off it. And of course it worked. Yeah. She was out shopping. And he said, she's got no right to tell me what I can read, what I can't read. And he read it, he comes every week now. It does work sometimes. But just have fun. If they don't want to listen, then fine. You just, that's why you've got two ears for. One to go in, one to go out. How many of you, there's a lot of ladies here, how many got a husband? And when you talk to him, he says, yes, darling, yes, darling, yes, darling. And you say, you're not really listening to me, are you? And he said, yes, darling. That's why when husbands say to their wives, you know, oh, the husbands say to their wives, you women speak so much. And she replies, yes, because that's because you never listen. Pardon? Because you never listen. I better stop telling these jokes, I get in more trouble. Please could you offer guidance on meditation practice to fully understand and experience. Oh, Ne Tang Mama, Ne So Hamasmi, Na Me So Atati. In Ne Tang's much different than Ne So. It's just, I don't know if any of you have done any Latin, but Misha means this. And if this is, like, have these things as masculine, feminine, neuter, and stuff like that, it doesn't mean there's any femininity in it or masculinity in it. It's just the way that people would make these nouns. So it's not me, not mine, not a self. And just the etang, aizo, depends on what's coming next. That's all. So there's no difference there. It's just grammar. And what is understanding experience? It's not me, not mine, not a self. If it really was yours, was you, a self, you'd be able to control it. That's what it means by mine. This is my box, so I can control it. I own it. It's mine. But how often what you think is yours, you can't control. When you die, you let go of everything, your body and everything else. I work so hard as a student, learning quantum physics and I've even forgot the word now. The Einstein's general theory of relativity and special theory of relativity. Oh, that was really tough to learn. But if you gave me an exam on it now, I'm sure to fail. All that hard work, all the stuff you learnt when you were a kid, you forget it eventually, and it all disappears. It's not yours. It doesn't belong to you. Not me, not mine, not a self. So what actually don't you lose? Actually, when you get older and many of those other things disappear, the one thing which you'll always have is your kindness and wisdom. Characteristics, not knowledge. How you regard things, rather than the idea of owning things. That's why even today somebody asked me to sign one of the books for... where's Anusha's mum and dad? I know, are they here? Yeah, they're here. For Anusha, it's her birthday soon. So she wanted a book, gave her the book on the art of disappearing. And that is one of my favourite books. And it's all about you don't own anything. Let go. It's much more free. Disappear. The less you own, the less you are. Do you own your meditation? Is it your meditation? On Wednesday night I gave a talk to the monks and the nuns about why do people always say my practice, my meditation? my retreat. We get into these silly habits. It's not your practice. You just disappear more and more and more. You let go, vanish. It's not yours. Imagine you really understood that. Not me, not mine, not a self. You got nothing to worry about. Nothing you own. Nothing to be taken away from you. Nothing to gain. You're at peace. Your workload has just been disappeared. Do that for your meditation. This is not my practice. I don't own this. That was for, I mentioned to the monks, for 6 months I did my own silent retreat. Never saw a human being in 6 months. Never talked to anybody for 6 months. Saw animals in the forest, but never saw anybody, any human being, never spoke. And the thing which I, the teaching which I took with me, I had it written down, was the Buddha's Sermon on Non-Self, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. That's where, you know, it keeps on saying, not me, not mine, not a self. If it was mine, I'd be able to control it. I'd be able to tell my thoughts and my body and my happiness, my suffering, I'd be able to tell it what to do, to control it. You can't. You get very frustrated trying to control things. So what do? You let them go. And they let them go, they get very peaceful, and now you know how to meditate. You don't do it. I take no responsibility for my meditation. When I don't, you get really peaceful. You try and prove something to somebody, and you get very tense. Let it go. Be peaceful. See what happens. And then you go down the cliff, you make perfect turns, and you don't have to take hold of the wheel at all. How is it you can get so much joy in giving to the point it helps meditation? Whoa, that's easy. Most of us just get tired bodily. And do we always have to slow down to be able to let go? Ah, not really. But sometimes if you go very fast, then you have to let go of a lot of money when the police catch you and fine you. So even going fast, you have to let go of things. But they get so much joy. This was a weird thing. I couldn't understand this at first. But you experiment. I have got a lot of kindness, I reckon. And well, not mine, but it just seems to be that way. And I remember this occasion when 3 monks were making their robes in northeast Thailand. And you had to do it by hand. Get the white cloth, cut it up, sew it up, and then get the dye from the well. The water from the well, boil it up, get the dye, which is now chopping up fallen branches of the jackfruit tree, and then dye the robe. And it's not easy to dye, you have to pound it, there's no machines or anything, and when you actually dry it, you have to be with it all the time, otherwise it will streak. And it was really a lot of work. It's not just one robe, your whole set of 3 robes being a monk. So a lot of work. And I've done it myself, you have to stay up at night, and this 3, because they're doing it all together, they had to stay up about 3 nights. That's not sleeping for about 72 hours or 80 hours or something. And after a couple of days, and I saw them, you're supposed to do it yourself, that was like our monastery rule. But then I saw that they were so tired. And so after the evening meeting, you know, it's a bit rough for them. So I said, look, I'll look after the dye pots. You know, you go off and have a 3 or 4 hours of rest, and you can come back afterwards. Just don't tell anybody because I'm breaking the rules. And so that's what they did. They never argued. They never sort of debated with me. Well, you sure want to do this? They were off. And when the morning bell went over there at 3 a.m. The morning bell went, and they came out about 10 past. And, you know, I was just, you know, I didn't want to sort of let them, people know that they'd broken, let me break the rules for them. So I went off to the morning meeting, and the chanting and the meditation in the morning. Perfect posture. Chanting really loud. Yo, so, Bagawa. I have so much energy. And even on the arms round, when I went on the arms round, I just wasn't tired at all. I've been up all night. I couldn't believe this. Why is it that, you know, I haven't slept all night, but got more energy than I've had for weeks and months? And I asked the senior monk, he said, that's what happens when you give to others. That's what he said. And I thought, wow, that's so true. Helping and serving, just it needs to be done. You get so much joy and so much energy as well. That's why all these other stupid things you did. Over in Thailand, you know, that same as in Sri Lanka, you know, you wash monks' feet. And over in northeast Thailand, it was the monks' privilege. We could wash Ajahn Chah's feet. And I thought it should have like a roster. Like, you on Monday, you on Tuesday, you on Wednesday. But that's not how it worked. There was no rosters. It was totally disorganized. And he had about six or seven monks on each foot. And I thought, that's ridiculous. And also, you know, Ajahn Chah was old enough to wash his own feet anyway, but that wasn't the point. But the only way to check what's going on is to try it yourself. Because, you know, that's what you're brought up as an experimenter, as a scientist. You know, what's going on? The only way you can really know is give it a go. And that's when I remember this. There's a few things you really remember, which was both fun but quite surprising. So you had to be fast. So I came back early, just got everything ready, and waited for Ajahn Chah, just like a cat waiting to pounce. And you had to be fast, because everyone else, quite a few other monks were doing that as well. And when he actually came around the corner, I was up. I was fast. And I got a toe all to myself. And I was blissing out. It's stupid, Ajahn Brahm. It's only a toe. Why are you so happy? But I was. And that's where you started to really understand the power of giving, of being kind. That's why, how many times do I open the door to you? Is a senior monk supposed to do that in Sri Lanka or anywhere? Open the door for you? I'm even a Chow Kun. I'm not supposed to do that in Thailand. Chow Kun, they're supposed to open the door for you. But I get so much fun out of that. So much joy. And even and that's why I had some ice cream today at lunch. It's only a little bowl of ice cream. But that bowl of ice cream was on top of some ice in a big bucket of ice. The little bowl of ice cream was actually bigger than my arms bowl. Wasn't it? That was good old Nicholas. And normally I think, oh, come on, just give me some ice cream. That's a little bit, that's enough. I'll put it inside my bowl or something. Because I've had that many times. Ice cream on spaghetti. Strawberry ice cream on spaghetti bolognese. Have you ever had that? Why did you, show signs of disgust? You've never eaten it. You're right, it is disgusting. But anyway. But just to do things like that and just, you enjoy it so much. That's been a part of our path. Any opportunity, ever in the Dhanasala, you know that somebody, maybe your partner or something here, a good friend, you know they like something, and there's only one left, one last banana. You know, like say Ananda likes bananas or something. You take it, because he's coming in late, and you give it to him. Even though you love bananas, you give it to somebody else. You get so much joy doing stuff like that. And so then I get into that as well if I possibly can. So that's one of the reasons why giving is, when you don't have to, is lots of joy, lots of happiness, lots of energy. Ajahn Brahm, please let us know how to get rid of distracting thoughts during meditation. My mind likes to drift off super fast. How to get rid of unnecessary bad thoughts and stay focused during normal daily activities. Don't try to get rid of thoughts. That feeds them. Oh, I think I've said this. It can sometimes I get criticized for, you know, being honest. But I remember my sixth rains retreat. It's this beautiful monastery up in the north of Thailand. It was absolutely perfect. There was a traffic problem, which was one car a week, if you managed to see it. And the village was just over the hill on the other side. So you couldn't hear what they were up to in your little monastery. And caves. I love caves. There's some really deep, wonderful caves. And go in there just after breakfast or lunch, whatever you always call it, one meal a day, and stay there till the afternoon. A brilliant meditation there. And that is one of the reasons why, just outside of that cave, the entrance, there was a papaya tree. And the bats would live in that cave, obviously. And that's where they would poo, going in and going out. And that was the sweetest, most delicious papaya I'd ever eaten in my life. Whenever there was one up there, you know, I let the villagers know just how sweet it was. So they were always offering me, like, whole papaya, you'd eat the whole lot. It was just so delicious. And that's actually where I got the simile from. Of you step in the dog poo, put it on the mango tree, and then your mangoes are sweeter and juicier than ever before. It was a real story. That was come from the papaya tree. But it's such a beautiful monastery, and I love that monastery. People never really bothered you. The other thing which they did there, I told monks this as well, the one day I did tell the lay people, just, you know, one of my favourite sweets was like fried bananas, you know, in batter. I just told them that, and just one morning, just for my one meal a day, that's all I got. No rice, no curries, no other sweets, nothing except... I was sick of fried bananas after that. That's all I ate. I don't know why this... Does that happen to you when you just... That's why these days you try and not let people know what you like, otherwise that's all you get. It taught me a lesson, though, very quickly. But anyway, up in that monastery. And the last time I told that story, I think in Nolamara, the next day, you know what I got? Fried bananas. Oh, go away. So anyway, at that monastery... The serious stuff, it was absolutely perfect. No way of complaining at all. The weather was nice. Six rains. So I was tired. I knew what I was doing. So I thought. And then you got into a bad patch in meditation. The mind started thinking and thinking and thinking. And, you know, I tried to stop the thoughts. Try to watch my breath. Come on, you're a good monk. You've done this before. Watch your breath. Every time I tried to watch my breathing, just all these thoughts would just break down the door, as a metaphor, and just come inside. And the thoughts got worse and worse and worse, more and more embarrassing. I was the only monk in that monastery. There was no telephone or anything, so I couldn't ask anybody. And that's why you started having all these romantic thoughts. I was only 29. I had a good education, still handsome. I started thinking, I wonder if she's still available. Stop it, Ajahn Brahm. You want to be a monk. And the thing was, the more I tried to stop it, the worse they got. And I was just really going crazy. And so I bowed to the Buddha statue in the hall. That's all I could speak to. And said, help. And I got this wonderful insight. It wasn't an insight, it was just a start of some insights. He said, why not just make a deal? And that's what Westerners do, make deals. For all the day, I just, you know, watch my breath and meditate. But from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon, I could think whatever I want. Any weird sexual fantasy, thinking of old girlfriends or whatever. anything goes from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. So if you know my wants to do that, 3 to 4, you can do whatever you want. Rest of the time, behave. And then you know what happened? It wasn't exactly what I expected. The mind was still unable to be disciplined. So you know, the day I still had to fight hard to keep those thoughts from invading my mind. When it got to 3 p.m., I thought, okay, mind, now you can think anything you want, any sort of embarrassing, sexual, weird, romantic thing you ever want to think, now you can. And this is no exaggeration, this really shocked me. For the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. It was so easy. And that was a true experience of weird insight. How come that happened? When I was fighting my mind, it was misbehaving. When I was letting my mind be, it became really peaceful and so easy to meditate. So whatever thoughts you're thinking, even the most weirdest ones, let them be. You don't own them. They're not me, they're not mine, they're not the self. If you own them, I think you own them, then you have to battle them. Yeah, they're your problem. When you realize they're not you, they just vanish. They disappear and you can watch breath really easy. That's how you overcome those thoughts. And just the last, actually the first sutta class I've given for a long time was this removal of distracting thoughts. And the one which of those five methods, the one which I liked the best was finding out the cause of those thoughts. Why are you thinking? Why is the mind restless? And for years and years I wondered, why can't you do something simple, just to be here and watch your breath or something, and just watch the peaceful mind? Why do you keep thinking? It's because you haven't got a beautiful attitude to your mind. Your mind and your thoughts just are fighting each other. That's no way to live in peace. So get the attitude right to your mind. Be kind to your mind. Be kind to your brain. And then after a while, just the thoughts, they don't disturb you anymore. And I say that because if you have a good relationship with somebody, just a friend, then you just like to hang out together. But if, say, the boss at work, that boss at work you really don't get on with, oh my goodness, you try any excuse to get out of the room, get out of the office, go to the toilet, make some excuse to be somewhere else, because you don't have a good relationship. You have a good relationship with, you know, your meditation practice, of course it's not going to run away. You're going to hang out together, just like, you know, sometimes that I have to do a lot of work. But just like this afternoon, because, you know, there was no interviews, and I came back from the from Bodhinyana just about 12:45 or something, and then I think, oh, wow, I've got the whole afternoon. Don't have to do anything until 7 o'clock. So, wow, me and my mind hang out together. No one disturbed us. I don't know about you, I had a wonderful afternoon. I really enjoyed myself. Because I was with my best friend. That's actually how you stop wandering thoughts. You don't want to wander off. You don't want to drift off. You don't want to escape. Can you please teach us how to do walking meditation for beginners? Yes. Who's the most junior nun? Are you up for it? Yeah, come on. Because with walking meditation, we have to adapt it to the culture which we're in. So, years and years ago, we developed kangaroo walking meditation. Are you okay doing this? I'm not going to do it. No, come on, it's a bit of fun. Good girl. So, first of all, your posture. You have to put your hands up like this. And you don't walk. Have you ever seen kangaroos walking? They don't walk, they hop. So hop. One. Mindfully. Two. Mindfully. Excellent. Thank you so much. So you start in the beginning of the walking meditation, Paul. I wouldn't ask anyone to do what I wouldn't do. So I did that once. I was in Penang because there was no other junior nuns or anything I could actually dob in. So I had to do it myself. And as soon as I started doing my walking meditation kangaroo style, you wouldn't believe just how fast people get out their mobile phones and turn on the video. It was all on the internet. But no, real walking meditation, you know how to walk. So you start on one end of the path and you walk naturally. Not fast, I mean, not like a kangaroo. So that's, if you get bored and you want to be kind to others and you find out, you know, during the maybe late afternoon, 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, you know, towards that time, you see people just losing some energy out of kindness to others. You can do that in the meditation hall, in the walking meditation hall. Everybody would actually have a big boost of energy because of your wonderful service for others. And you would have a boost of energy as well, because sometimes we get a bit restless, a bit tired, a bit bored. But anyway, what you do, you start at the beginning. Doesn't matter which foot you move first. No, we're walking meditation. Put your attention a couple of meters in front of you, body length basically. Keep your eyes open, but on the ground, not to the left, not to the right, in front of you. And you walk to the end of the path, slowly. Try to notice exactly how many muscles are moving just to move your foot forward and down. And then transferring the weight from one leg to another, and then the other foot moves up and goes forward and goes down. And then you get to the end of the path. You don't watch your breath, because that divides the mind. You're just watching the walking, you're observing. And not thinking about, you know, the meaning of life or the problems in the government or something else like that, or who's winning the cricket match, if there's a cricket match on for you Sri Lankans or Indians. Instead, you're just being with the feelings in your feet. That's wonderful. I love that walking meditation. And I remember just doing all this walking meditation over in Thailand. And the experience which I relate, many of you have heard it before. My first year as a monk, I was doing 1 hour of walking meditation across the hall, maybe from here to the end, and then from the end back again. It was natural. It took an hour. Half an hour there, half an hour back. Just because there was so much going on in your feet. You couldn't rush it. And as I was, it was natural. I wasn't trying to show off or anything. Sometimes people do try and show off. When you're walking meditation in one of those halls and a few other people are walking in there, you know, sometimes there's a race to who's the slowest. I mean, that's the ego's thing, and just don't get into that. But anyway, it just became natural. And then I just, maybe a quarter of an hour, you know, another 10 meters or so before I was going to reach the end. And then, a weird experience. It's like you hear this sound in the distance. Really long way away, but it's really clear. And then I took my attention away from the feet, and there was a monk shouting in my ear. Honestly, that's what how was happening. I'd forgot I was supposed to go for some sort of dana, some ceremony. And for him to get my attention was so difficult. Even though I was only a very junior monk, but still I had to listen And it was hard, because you're just so into the peace and the... Because he knew that, you know, what happens when monks meditate, sort of, you know, he gave me a lot of patience. And eventually I just turned around to him. It took about a couple of minutes. You know, moving your neck, it's amazing how many muscles have to move. And it's just really fascinating. And when I actually got his eye contact, what? If this was a Westerner, they'd have taken me away and put me in hospital or something. This was in Thailand, they knew what meditation was. And they knew that sometimes you're so slow, it takes a while, even though you're trying your hardest, to actually get going again. And that's with walking meditation. And I thank him for that, because it showed me just how peaceful you can get in walking meditation. You don't think, you feel. Feel your feet moving. Even right now, can you feel your left foot? Don't look at it, just feel it. Move it slightly. That's what you're doing when you do walking meditation. You're feeling, experiencing the sensations in your feet. And after a while, you really get into it. That's why, that, as I say, I just love walking barefoot, no socks or shoes on, when I go from here over to my room. Feel the texture of all the things in this compound here. You walk on the grass around the stupas, on the bamboo floor. There's so much on the concrete, on the tiles. Do you know the difference between those feelings? After a while, you really get into it. That's walking meditation, great fun. My meditation in the morning, I like the dream state, full of imaginary stories. Is this good, bad, or who knows? Should I stay more alert? If so, how? No, just let it develop. This is only the beginning of the retreat. So, it's good, at least you're meditating. And just carry on and see if the dream state vanishes. See what happens. But do make sure you're getting enough rest. If you really are sleepy, so the person sitting next to you just says, "You're snoring," then that's a sign that you need to take some more time to sleep. Now, John Burke, can you please give us some advice on meditation in a mask? This is my first retreat with a mask. I'm finding it hard to relax my breathing. You seem so relaxed. What is your secret? If you don't like meditating in the mask, then give a talk. You don't have to wear. Any of the nuns just fed up with the mask? Want to? No, they're all quiet. But no, I said this to the retreat manager earlier, Robin, that if you really find it difficult wearing a mask, then meditate in your room. In your room, you don't have to wear a mask. You can if you want. I'm not going to force you not to wear a mask when you're by yourself. But it's like free in there. And that's why, just honestly, that I love to meditate in silence in my room. And it's also, I don't know, some of you, I'd even like Robin, you're wearing a blanket now. How can you bear that with a blanket? You must be boiling inside. Even right now, this room is really warm for me. So when I go in my room, there's an aircon in my room. So I can, but I haven't used it yet because it's already cool enough. I can actually take my robe off. And it's nice and cool for me. So in your room, you've got the best temperature for yourself. And you can find a nice place, and it's much quieter in rooms than in here. People coming in, going out, coughing, goodness knows what else. But that's why, if you don't like wearing the mask, just go inside a room. As long as you're by yourself, it's okay. But it's also true that if you have to be in here and you're just meditating, after a while you just don't notice it anymore. You know, the air is a bit constricted after a while. Because when you walk in, you know, it's a bit of exercise. When you sit here and do nothing, you don't need so much air. So because you don't need so much air, just after a while, you're just breathing in, breathing out, no problem. What are your thoughts on narrating our own meditation? Oh, goodness. I sometimes remind myself some of your lessons during meditation. Seems to help, but does that restrict my progress since it's technically not fully letting go? It's okay every now and again, but not too much. Because sometimes people give too many instructions to their poor old mind, and your mind gets confused. The stimuli I give is, suppose it gets to the time the retreat ends, that's when it's on Saturday afternoon, isn't it? Next week? Sunday morning, yeah. When it ends. So you order a taxi to take you to the airport to get your flight back to wherever you're going to go. And so the taxi comes, and then you get in the back seat and you tell the taxi driver, I need to get to Perth Airport, terminal, I don't know what terminal it is, terminal 3, say. I need to get to, now, I've just been on a retreat, so don't talk, turn the radio off, and don't drive too fast. I'm a Buddhist, so you can always let other people cut in front of you. Please don't rush at the lights, because, you know, we've got enough time. I don't want to cause a problem to anybody. If you see any animals on the road, please slow down. And then if you keep talking like that to a taxi driver, he'll throw you out before you get to the front gate. Sometimes people are control freaks like that. So it's okay to give one instruction. The taxi driver, I need to get to Terminal 3. Then shut up. And enjoy the ride. Is that enough? So sometimes you can give too many instructions. And especially as you get into the deeper meditation states, please no instructions. That really disturbs it. In the beginning it's sort of okay. You get deeper, you have to be quiet. And the mind will know what to do. It will just, you know, that everything you've heard will just allow you to go in the right direction. When I am meditating, I fall asleep, even in a chair. What shall I do? Please sit in the chairs with the armrests. And you can please ask Robin for the seat belts, safety belts. Because otherwise, if you sit in the chair and you fall asleep, we don't have insurance for that. You fall out. Every now and again, I sometimes hear banging. I thought it was just the door being banged. I didn't realize somebody had fallen out of the chair. No. If you fall asleep when you start meditating, it means you're not really having enough sleep. So just go back to your room and just take a nap. And then when you come back, people think I'm just indulging you. It's not indulging, because this has happened so often. People complain, oh, I'm just always really dull and sleepy when I'm meditating. And I say, just go back to your room and just lay down and take a nap. I can't do that, that's just indulging. Go back to your room and take a nap. Don't set the alarm clock. However long you sleep, that's enough. And then when you get up, have a shower, a cup of tea or juice or something, and then come and meditate. I can't do that, that's indulgent. Do it. So off they go and they just go and take a nap. If it really is the right time, you fall asleep straight away. Now, if it is indulgent, you know, you can't go to sleep. And then afterwards you have a shower or something, have a juice or something to drink, and then you come and meditate. I mention this because so many people said that was the best meditation of the whole retreat. When they're caring for their body. Give your body a bit of a break, a bit of a rest, and it's like afterwards your body says, thank you for looking after me. Now I'll look after you. And your body will allow you to get into a really nice meditation. Give it a try. Dear Ajahn, after relaxing the body, the mind seems to stay with me. Yay! For a while before it wanders off. Oh, goodness. Well, learn how to relax the mind as well. How can we make something so it is interesting enough S-T-H. Okay, and that means sati or whatever, I don't know. So it is interesting enough for the mind to say, is a meditation object needed? Will that then seem a controlling effort rather than putting down and letting go? I am not sure how to balance efforts and no control. Please help. It's the effort to stop, the effort to say no, the effort of renunciation. Renunciation, giving up control. That takes effort to say no, to renounce, and see what happens. It's always really great. You've got to be patient. Remember what I said about the cup? You put it down, you don't put it down long enough. And you go, it's not peaceful yet. Something's wrong, it's not peaceful. I've got to do something. Give it time. You've got 8 or 9 days in this meditation retreat. See what happens. What is your view on tough love? That's not a love which I know. And I never practice that. What are we being tough for? That's not what the Buddha said. Be soft. Be gentle. Be kind. That is much more powerful than tough love. Whatever tough love is. I've never seen anyone get anywhere with being tough on yourself. You just get after a while frustrated. Being tough with everybody in this. I suppose we could try that as an experiment. Could you please lock all the doors? So we're not going to go to bed this evening. We're just going to stay here. Can I have a Zen stick? No, sometimes tough love. Have you ever received tough love from anybody? Does it really work? So instead of that, try the kindness, and then people want to work with you. They realize what, and just be a good communicator so they know what you're saying or why you're saying it. Every time which, you know, there's punishments or fines and stuff, what do fines in Western Australia do? Like, you know, speeding fines. They just manage to get you to get these little devices you can put in your cars so you know where the speed cameras are. They warn you, speed camera, slow down. They don't actually tell you why you should not speed. So that's one of the things which, if someone had explained to me why we have precepts, what was the purpose of them? And then if that was explained, well, you don't need to actually to look over people, make sure they're keeping them. Know why they're there. Not killing anybody. Imagine if we didn't have that precept here. You'd have to lock your doors and put securities on your doors. You don't know, it might be a psychopath. The Buddha ordained Angulimala. He was a serial killer. Are you sure you're safe this evening? We've never had any problems here. Everyone's been really good because they've been kind. That's the most important part. The kindness. Stealing. Oh, there's sometimes that, you know, there's money in a donation box or there's credit cards over here, there's expensive stuff there. But have we ever had anything stolen from Jhana Grove? I can't remember ever. I don't think we have. We did have something stolen from Bodhinyana Monastery, from the tool shed. That was so wonderful. It was all insured, so we got new stuff. And we actually made money out of that, just replaced a lot of old tools and some we didn't want. And then we got new top quality tools. We always wanted to find out who that burglar was and invite them back. It's been quite a few years now. And I must say, I'll be honest with you, that once there was a burglar who robbed in Dhammaloka Centre. And they went even to the monks' quarters. And they took my little tablet, you know, the computer tablet. And when they did, yes, now I can get a new one. But then they took one look at it, and they didn't like it, and they just left it behind the main hall. One of the monks said, "They found your tablet, they found your tablet." Oh, well, that's life. So anyway, so this is safe here. So it's only tough love. It's just kindness. Kindness is much more powerful. Even just, you know, all these talks I give you, all the jokes and the kindness and the stories. Is there anything tough about that? Wisdom is much better than toughness. And love is opening the door of your heart, no matter what happens. Is that tough? That word tough doesn't really just make sense to me. So, thank you for this opportunity to feel so peaceful. My question relates to the practice of yoga, which is often coupled closely with meditation. If stillness helps to calm the mind and induce a deep meditation, how does yoga with its body movement inhibit or support deep meditation practice? Even when I was young, and I did yoga just to get my body nice and loose. And then, later on in my life as a monk, I don't know if you've been here such a long time, you must have seen me. Remember when I injured my back? And I was like doubled over. And you know, I couldn't straighten my back. And about for 5 or 6 months. I know exactly how it happened. The front wall of Bodhinyana Monastery, now I was the builder, and the concrete truck came, and the concrete went off really fast. And I had to work really just full on to level it all, because once concrete goes off, you know, you can't sort of take it out and just mend it afterwards. You've got just a few minutes to make all the levels correct, and that's it. And so afterwards, I knew I just, you know, I should have stretched my back or something or stopped, but I couldn't because I was afraid the concrete would just solidify. And so afterwards, my back was really injured. About 6 months, it just really bent over. But then eventually, what really got it together again, I read this book by a New Zealand fellow, it was Heal Your Own Back, and it was just simple yoga, the cobra pose. I do that every morning. I just, you know, stretch the back, and just the back just healed itself. I've had no problem ever since. So, you know, thanks to learning a bit of yoga. So it's good for your health. And it's good for, you know, curing things and getting your legs and your back nice and easy for meditation. I'm 70 years old now, and I can sit down without any problems. Thanks for all that sort of stretching and yoga stuff I did when I was young. And that's one of my first spiritual heroes. It was on the TV, Yogi Bear. You all know who he was. That was when I was a kid. He's still going anyway. I think that's enough. Is there any other comments or questions before we finish off? No? Okay. Sadhu. 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 Oh. Oh, is that... Well, that's it. Everyone got done. Okay, so it's 8:10. So those of you who want to carry on meditating, you're most welcome. You want to go and have a rest, you're quite welcome. If you want to sort of decide to do some walking meditation or hopping meditation. And thank you so much for doing that. You're very kind. Okay.